Today is Wednesday. It's March 29th, 2017. It's 10:56 a.m. This is John Williams, and you're listening to Playing Politics, a weekly podcast we record in the studios of WCCO. We visit each week with members of the Star Tribune editorial board, or perhaps I should say members of the editorial board of the Star Tribune. Meet with me, John Williams. If you're not listening to this right now, at the WCCO Radio Facebook page. You can always catch it there. We post it there and on my own Facebook page. And we broadcast part of this Wednesday afternoons on WCCO.
I'm John Ratch, columnist and editorial writer for the Star Tribune.
And I'm DJ Tice. I'm commentary editor and a columnist at the Star Tribune.
Hi, DJ. Hi, John. Hey. How are you guys?
How are you?
You like how in the introduction I sort of stole the ownership and authorship of this thing? This is a podcast you guys started a long time ago, and it's a pleasure to be part of it and also to put some of it on WCCO Radio. Fellas, let's start a little bit with, once again, what's been happening in Washington, D.C. Remember, we timestamp these podcasts, too, now because things happen so quickly. If you wonder, why didn't we talk about X? It may be because it happened X plus 5 minutes ago, and things are moving that quickly. We'll start maybe today with the climate change rules that the president has rolled back. He said, yes, we need clean water and we need clean air. But he also said these rules have been too onerous and we need to roll some of them back. John, what does this mean for all of us? And is this going to help business? Is that the idea behind it?
I think the idea behind it is to try to uphold campaign promises he made very specifically to coal miners in West Virginia and Kentucky and in Pennsylvania and states like that. Whether or not his rollback is actually implemented remains to be seen, because as opposed to an executive order that can just happen instantaneously, this one needs to go through a legal process, and there certainly will be plenty of people lining up to fight any rollback to these clean energy rules that were invoked and passed and moved forward during the Obama era.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it might mean, though, from a much broader perspective, is it sends a signal to so many nations who were part of the landmark Paris Climate Change Agreement of just a few years ago, that perhaps the United States won't be able to or won't be willing to uphold its end of that landmark treaty. And so whether or not that has any impact on what the other big carbon emitters like China and India and elsewhere do remains to be seen. But it is a great example of elections having consequences, and this mm-hmm. is something the president ran on. Now, marketplaces have consequences as well, and part of the challenge for coal miners isn't just the legislative process, but the economic one. And the fracking revolution has made natural gas, which burns cleaner, also less expensive. And that's been a much bigger driver of fewer jobs in Appalachia than anything else.
Yeah, so if he makes it easier to mine coal or burn coal, that doesn't change the fact that it'll still be less expensive to burn natural gas. I wonder, DJ, if he's just looking for something that he can say, okay, I promised it and I followed through on it, on the heels of the healthcare non-vote.
Yeah, he needs to deliver and cross the T's, dot the I's on something. And this is not going to be all that easy either. I mean, in addition to the political challenge of getting needed legislation, there's almost certain to be legal challenges of many kinds. And as you guys point out, the problems of the coal economy are much deeper than regulatory. But there's also symbolically, of course, this is a very prominent occasion for him to deliver on his generalized crusade to roll back regulation in the economy.
I'm sorry, roll back
regulation.
Yeah, but I mean, what does the wall have to do with regulation? You mean, I'm lost here. He said we need to build a wall. You know what?
I'm talking about the coal and the climate change.
Yeah, and you can tell my mind just skipped over to the wall because I was just reading online a story about that. Pardon me, DJ.
That's all right.
So if he rolls back some of these regulations, how does that, do you guys know, specifically help coal miners? Is it an environmental rollback, or what's the sort of stimulus that's going to put the miners back to work?
Well, part of what he did in the executive order is he lifted a moratorium on new coal leases on federal land, so that theoretically could create more jobs for miners, and initiating a review of the Clean Power Plan. And so if the idea is you roll back these regulations and open up more areas to coal mining, you know, that it would create more jobs for the kind of coal miners who stood behind President Trump as he signed this yesterday. But as all three of us have been talking about, the political environment is one thing. The legal and most important marketplace environment is distinctly different. So, you know, I think that it was the optics matter to the people who supported and voted for President Trump, but the actual delivery of this is going to be much harder down the line.
How much of the next steps going forward will still fall on the heels of the healthcare non-vote, the failed effort to pass a healthcare reform? Because a lot of people say that if you want a tax bill, then a lot of that was sort of predicated on things they were going to try and do with the healthcare bill, and that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, well, they were looking to, of course, eliminate a lot of the taxes that are connected with the ACA, with Obamacare in one way or another, not getting that accomplished, through the repeal, certainly blocks a lot of that agenda. The health care, again, everybody's looking for a way to succeed here, and it's hard to see that path for any of the players involved, including the Democrats, who've got to be uneasy with leaving the situation that we have with, you know, unstable insurance markets. But on the other hand, they're probably leery of doing anything that would help Trump score a big success become more normalized.
Yeah, which would be a shame. I mean, you know, if people are frustrated with the behavior of the president or the allegiance of Republicans, it would be a shame to see Democrats seize this moment politically and stall any improvements to health care. I mean, to be honest with you, fellas, when that thing went down yesterday, I sort of resented the people dancing a jig because we beat Donald Trump. To me, that says, okay, now we're not going to fix health care. That is how unaffordable it is for some people, and what a shame that is.
Well, I think you make a great point, John, and I think one of the very reasons why this legislation collapsed at the finish line is the very reason that it may be revived and restarted, and that some whispers from the White House seem to be just that, in that this profoundly matters to millions of Americans in terms of their ability to get and afford health care, and that's just something that both political parties ignore at their own peril. So there is incentive, even beyond the normal political point scoring that exists inside the Beltway, to try to get something done. Most Americans would agree that it would be much better if it was bipartisan as opposed to a much more partisan attempt as the Affordable Care Act and then this most recent congressional bill, which was backed only by Republicans.
Yeah. Well, and you wonder how much sway the president has right now, too, since everything right now is hanging in the sort of under the cloud of this Russian investigation. DJ, what's jumping out at you about all of that today?
Well, you know, it is a daily eruption of weirdness on this front, and I confess to being somewhat exhausted by it, but you know, clearly the investigation in the House committee has lost credibility with a good part of the, American people. And it's not going to be successful in putting the matter to rest. You know, whether the investigations within the law enforcement community by the FBI and so on will be more successful is hard to say. The Senate could step forward with an investigation of its own. The Senate generally is, you know, a less polarized and chaotic institution than the House. That might go somewhat better. But at the Star Tribune, we've been calling for some kind of an independent commission, truly independent, to be named. And it does seem that in the end, that may be the only sort of approach that would get us, you know, to a set of answers to the questions that are going to be satisfying.
Well, DJ, do you think that if this cloud hadn't hung over us, would healthcare have had a better chance? I mean, it just seems to be such a toxic and bizarre and super polarized environment because of these, you know, allegations about election interference. I wonder if that weren't there, if the healthcare bill or any of these other things would have a better
chance. Well, no doubt it makes everything more difficult. And Yet, healthcare would be a heavy lift under all circumstances, as it has been for years and decades. But sure, I think everything would be easier, including probably the Supreme Court nomination that's hanging fire and all of these other
sure,
agenda
think about
items.
That. I mean, that was red hot a week ago and 2 weeks ago and a month ago, and we aren't even talking about that. I have to confess to you guys, every day I don't know what needs to be on the top of my heap. Should it be the Supreme Court investigation, the climate change stuff? Should it be the Russian allegations? Should it be the tax bill we're not talking about or the health bill? Or should we just worry about whether or not Ivanka has an unpaid office in the White House?
Well, or terrorism. You know, we had another terror attack at one of the major capitals of the world, and that was about a five-hour story.
Well, and I think it's really not just you, John, who's contending with this. You know, as someone who discusses these issues in the public sphere, there seems to be a distinct unfocused approach by the Trump administration itself in terms of what they're going to push at any particular time. And certainly the president was keenly interested and invested in moving forward the health care debate. But when that didn't go forward, he immediately signaled that this was done at this point, and there was general acknowledgement that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was the law of the land. But there, you know, normally administrations have a very well telegraphed plan on their proverbial or literal first 100 days in terms of what they want to do, and the lack of focus is something that seems to be bedeviling this White House. And you mentioned the Russian issue. You know, a president's approval rating is an incredibly important component of his ability to either talk directly to the American people to get them to rally representatives and senators behind a specific legislative initiative, and in particular to be able to talk to members of your own party up on Capitol Hill when you're going for your first big initiative, that it would certainly hurt the president and the party if, you know, they stumbled on the first way out. But as DJ just mentioned, you know, this was a heavy lift under any circumstances, and the degree that it impacts people personally meant that it just wasn't going to go forward.
Well, so then what does this mean with respect to the Gorsuch hearing? They would prefer to have 60 votes. They could execute a nuclear option and only do it with 51. Not exactly sure how that happens, but why wouldn't they if they could? Because I'm not sure they're going to get 60 votes out of the Senate. I have no trouble, to be honest with you, with Neil Gorsuch. Philosophically, I do on some issues, but he seems to me to be eminently qualified, and elections have consequences. In my world, he gets to be a Supreme Court justice. I wonder if some of the Democrats, though, seizing the momentum, are going to stall his hearing, either because of the current conditions or maybe because they're still a little ticked about the fact that President Obama didn't even get a hearing on his nominee.
Well, I think they're a good deal more than a little ticked by the Merrick Garland episode of last year, where President Obama's choice to fill the seat of the late Justice Scalia did not even get a hearing, you know, much less a vote. And Garland, I think, was by consensus an eminently well qualified and mainstream choice as well. So, you know, there's definitely a spirit of payback, and you add to that just the enormously you know, polarized and strife-filled atmosphere. It's hard to imagine that we're not going to have to go all the way to a filibuster and a nuclear option to overcome that. The end result will be Gorsuch on the court, which will be one stabilizing event, actually, because it will restore the court to a nine-justice panel that can actually decide all the cases, even the closely divided cases, which it has not been able to do over the past year. So that will be good, but the process, I'm afraid, will probably only deepen the divisions.
Do you fellas know how Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken would vote on Gorsuch's
hearing? They both announced that they will oppose.
I guess that doesn't surprise me with respect to Al Franken. He, Lord, had an entertaining exchange with him. I don't know if it was productive, but they sure had a tete-a-tete, didn't they? And then Amy said she won't vote for him either, huh?
Yes. Franken was both more obvious in the hearing with his opposition and quicker to announce that. But Klobuchar did here just yesterday, I think.
What do you guys think, though? Would you prefer to see the Democrats look less through their own filter on this and give him a pass? I wonder if that would be an overture that the country needs right now. I know that sounds Pollyanna-ish, but I wonder if that would be good for everybody.
I don't think it's Pollyanna-ish. I think that politicians have to choose where they're going to put their most significant effort. And most Americans would look at these hearings and say, as DJ just did, that elections have consequences and that this individual is eminently qualified, albeit, you know, despite the congressional kabuki theater that they go through every time, it's clear that he's more of an originalist, more of a conservative who would be on the bench, mm-hmm. maybe without the sharper edges of Justice Scalia, whom he would be replacing. But, you know, I think that the Democrats hope that Republicans will work with them on a bipartisan basis on issues that we've been discussing today, like the Russian investigation as an example here. And when you ask for bipartisanship, you have to at times return it. Whether this is the nominee that you would take to such a limit to invoke the so-called nuclear option, which would fundamentally change the rules of how Supreme Court nominees are voted upon, it doesn't necessarily seem to be the political payoff that they would hope. One thing I will say is that, you know, it cannot be forgotten, you know, just the contrast that exists here compared to what happened with Merrick Garland. What Democrats asked for at that time is, we realize a lot of Republicans will not vote to put him on the court, but he at least deserves a vote. And those elections, President Obama twice by significant margins, should have had consequences as well.
Yeah, well, it didn't happen that way. And some of my most liberal friends say, fine, you want to play? So that's now it's retribution time. Now it's time to do everything we can to sink and stall Neil Gorsuch's hearing and nomination.
Yeah, and, you know, this is just, it's so damaging to the institutional significance of the court. It's actually 30 years ago this year that Robert Bork was rejected by the Senate after a very bitter set of hearings, which really launched the modern politicized character of these confirmation hearings and confirmation battles. And people don't even remember, because that was 30 years ago, what the way things used to be, although we've seen it with some of the intervening justices. But the standard used to be that if a judge is well-qualified, experienced, and has no personal character flaws that surface that disqualify him or her, and is anywhere within the mainstream of legal analysis, that they were confirmed without a great deal of bitterness and controversy. Antonin Scalia was confirmed 98-0 back 31 years ago.
Boy, that's worth remembering, isn't it? The times have changed, haven't they?
Indeed, and DJ refers to this 30 years war as, I think, rightly taking away from the incredibly important institution of the Supreme Court and the, you know, the whole branch of government. I also think it detracts from the legislative branch of government and Congress as well. And at some point, both parties have to move beyond this, because I don't think that this inspires confidence in the very institutions that we need to govern us.
Well, I see everything as a referendum on the president. Wrongly, I see everything as a referendum on the president. Neil Gorsuch is an example. Healthcare is an example. I don't know what the next example is going to be, but I'll bet you Democrats aren't going to vote for funding a wall. Everything, and sometimes it will be principled, but sometimes it's going to be the man is down, they're reeling, let's not let them take a single step forward. Do you guys agree with my sort of overview of that?
I'm afraid that I do.
I'm afraid that I do as well, but I think it's going to be tested very severely in just the next few weeks as the country hurtles towards another debt ceiling deadline. And that is something that clearly concentrates the mind, and several occasions congressional Democrats push their Republican colleagues to be able to raise that debt ceiling. And so I think that might be a case clearly where there is some bipartisanship, because the outcome of defaulting on the debt or not being able to, you know, raise that kind of deadline are so extraordinary and so unpredictable at this mm-hmm. point that that might be a point that allows the parties to come together, albeit temporarily.
I think you're right that the stakes are very high, you know, in terms of the policy and the well-being of the country. Also, the political stakes there are significant, and it's a hazardous situation for all concerned to get to either a default or even a partial shutdown. Those things are politically unpredictable and treacherous. It might bring out the responsibility in all sides.
Well, that reminds me a little bit of the DJ, the healthcare vote. Yeah. I mean, I wonder when Tom Emmer comes back to his district, how people will or would have regarded him, say, if there were a vote. Would they have wanted Tom to, or Jason Lewis, would they have wanted them to vote for the president's plan or against the president's plan?
Well, that's, people obviously are going to be on different sides of that, but it's probably to their advantage. And I assume that both declared the support. I'm sure that Lewis did.
As did Eric Paulson in the third district here. And Representative Emmer was a little less vocal about it. But, boy, one of the things that you try not to do in politics is to get legislators to commit to an unpopular policy that isn't going to get passed. And this had 17% approval rating nationwide, and yet they got nearly every single representative on the record in terms of whether they supported it or not. Of course, all the Democrats said that they did not, but it really put some Republican representatives in a difficult position, and you better believe that that's going to be a compelling campaign point from their Democratic opposition. And when we get into the 2018 elections.
You know, I agree that the traditional rule is you never vote for an unpopular policy that won't become law, right? That's
they say that about taxes, yeah.
But
I was unfamiliar with that rule. Go ahead, DJ.
This may play just a little differently in that there's a situation at hand that is very problematic for people. And if you were in support, you can at least say, well, I was prepared to do something. And it's the other side that didn't want to do anything. And, you know, so you might be able to argue it a little bit differently. But the whole situation is a mess for all of them, that's for sure.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the political calculation. I'm not sure that passing the president's law bill would have been best for everybody anyway, but he campaigned on it. Tom Emmer certainly supported the president and most of his campaign promises. I'm sure Jason Lewis and Paulson did as well. But then, when push came to shove, I think the president blinked. He pulled the thing off the table. Maybe some of those uber conservatives, or I don't know if it was the moderates on the other end, but maybe some of those conservatives would have, fearing a no vote against the president, have at the last minute switched their vote. I wonder how our congressional delegation would have voted. And if they had voted, say, for that, because that's what the president promised and that's what they're supporting, how would that have hurt them when they came home? I wonder what the best vote for those guys would have been.
Well, of course, it depends on how it was going to turn out once they put it in place. I think what happened is the bill that they finally were able to assemble, that they thought they might be able to round up enough votes for, and that they could do under the procedural limitations because they had to get past a filibuster in the Senate, that bill made a lot of people nervous on both the left and the right that it was going to be at least as much of a mess as we have now, maybe more, and the Republicans were going to own it. Whereas right now, it's not quite sure who owns the mess we're in. Everybody owns a little
bit of
it.
Chuck Schumer does and Nancy Pelosi does. The president
Trump
told
is,
us that.
Yes, the president is sure.
Although it's quite striking that Nancy Pelosi in particular, because this, of course, was taking place in the House, she was against it, spoke out against it. But this was, the opposition was much more grassroots. And even Republican representatives say that, you know, as they became wary of this bill, it's because they heard from their constituents. And this seems to be nationwide, as there was very little outright support for this and a whole lot of opposition, including from many red states and red districts where Republicans had done so well in the previous election. So ownership, you know, remains to be seen in terms of what's going to happen. But in the end, it seems like no one wanted to own it, but their congressional opponents in 18 are going to try to make these representatives own it, even though it didn't become law.
Well, I just hope we don't lose our enthusiasm for making the premiums come down for some people. And I still think that means we have to find a way to get more people to buy into the program rather than opt out. I don't know how that's going to happen, but I hope they don't quit trying to do that, John. We need to fix that part.
Absolutely. And this is the bipartisan incentive that I spoke about. This is something that is amongst Americans' most significant, if not top worries, according to public opinion polls, and directly affects people's lives, including their lifespan and the ability, you know, to have insurance here. So, you know, the Democrats can't rest easy, even though the law remains, you know, in effect, because portions of it clearly are very, very challenging right now. And the Republicans campaigned on repeal and replace, and to just walk away from both seems to be very unwise as well.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of it would have fallen back on the states, and it would have been difficult for some of them to afford it or execute some of the promises of improved health care. We got another gubernatorial candidate, DJ. I would not want to run for governor or dog catcher these days. I do not want to play these games with sort of the consequences and some of the hard decisions these people have to make.
Yeah. Well, yes, Tim Walz, the Democratic DFL Congress member from southern Minnesota, jumped into the race. It was something that had been talked about. He had hinted at some interest in that, and now he's in. And I think in political circles, there's a lot of people who would say he's the front runner at this point. He is a very energetic campaigner. He's done a great job of becoming a recognized as a real kind of centrist Democrat who fits that that rural mix very well. He's a genuine problem solver, I've often thought, and you know, and I think that he will, you know, just play very well across Minnesota, and people will find him approachable and likable. So I think he's going to be a handful for the everybody else in the race.
Indeed, I think he would be a formidable general election candidate, particularly because he might be someone who can at least, you know, best bridge these rural urban exurban divides that are so distinct in Minnesota right now, so much against our longstanding state traditions. The challenge for him will be getting through the DFL caucus and primary process and getting the endorsement, because at least from the caucus perspective in the convention, that's much more dominated from those who are from the left-wing, you know, component of the DFL party, and mm-hmm. they may favor some other candidates. I think it was quite telling that he did not commit to abide by the endorsement and at least kept open the possibility that he's going to go to a primary, and, you know, he already has the support of a very similar you know, situation in terms of Representative Peterson up in the 7th District, parts of northern and northwestern Minnesota, you know, who is backing him there. So this is really going to be a compelling race. And then, of course, you have the whole Republican field that isn't as deeply developed as the DFL is right now, but I think we'll have some significant candidates as well.
Yeah, who are our options going to be? Who would your dream cast be of political stars who could run for and have a shot at winning governor?
Well, the I guess the race that I hear the most buzz about and am most intrigued with myself would be Walz and Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek, who has, again, hinted at some interest. He's not an official candidate, but he has raised his profile in recent years, both working with the anti-terror recruiting program in the Somali community and becoming really a national leader on raising the issue of the mentally ill being warehoused in our jails mm-hmm. across the country. And, you know, and he's a striking figure, and I think that he'd be a very formidable choice for the Republicans.
We've really had nice conversations with him the last couple of weeks, just because the president has called out some counties as not being sufficiently cooperative.
Sure.
And I think his explanation of his role as a law enforcement official and as a representative of the people of Minnesota has been very good. He's spoken to this issue, I think, really well.
And I think you make a great point there, John, in that he's very media savvy. Certainly Representative Walz and some others in the DFL field are as well. So, you know, I think I predict no matter who gets the nomination, it's highly likely to be a tight race. But in particular, if these two candidates who we're focusing on this in this podcast get the nomination, you're going to have quite a race. I think it remains to be seen, though, however, what the national situation is and to what degree that this turns into a referendum on the Republicans and President Trump in particular. Even if it's a disconnected race like the gubernatorial race, we've seen these elections increasingly nationalized for both parties, you know, effect in terms of some of President Obama's stumbles during his midterm elections. And you look back during George W. Bush's administration, where the DFL had an incredibly strong year in an off-year election based partly on people's unhappiness over what was happening with Iraq and Mideast policy, even though that was more just a tangential relationship to statewide issues.
Okay, here's my dream slate. Chris Coleman runs. Mm-hmm. R.T. Ryback runs. Mm-hmm. Both of our U.S. senators run. Does Jesse Ventura have any kids who are of age to run?
Tyler, I believe his son is certainly probably of age. Yes,
so. who else would be fun to throw in there? I don't think Betsy Hodges' roots go that far out.
What's
of
Michelle Bachmann up to? I don't know.
Actually, she has been a little quiet lately.
She has.
I wonder if she must miss the game a little bit. Okay, well, that's the end of this game. Any last comments from you two on either the St. Paul and Minneapolis side or the Washington, D.C. side, John? Anything that you want to get in here?
Well, since you mentioned Minneapolis, we have caucuses coming up here for a very compelling mayoral election and some formidable candidates there, including the incumbent Mayor Hodges. So that's going to be one to watch as well.
How about you, DJ?
Well,
same
thing in St. Paul. Chris Coleman is indeed running for governor, and yeah, we've got a lively race over there in St. Paul. You know, maybe one of the more prominent people being Pat Harris, who's been kind of a Coleman-esque leader over there for some time and has his endorsement. So we are going to have new leadership over there come what may.
You know, my problem is whenever I meet these people, I really like them. I like Chris Cole. I like every Republican I've met. Tom Emmer's always been nice to us on the show. And when I met him in person, he seems like a sincere, intelligent fella. He is. Chris Coleman, the same. I could tell you a number of Democrats that seem to be equally up to the task, likable and sincere. You know, we sort of caricature.
Well, this is because they're always on the air when they're talking to you, Joe.
They're on their best behavior, right? They hang up with me and, oh, the things they say. All right, well, then we'll hang up here and do this again next week. DJ Tice, thanks for joining
Pleasure.
Us this afternoon. And John Rash, we'll listen for you on the Morning News with Dave Lee, sir.
Thank you, John.
If you're not listening to this, it's startribune.com/opinion. You can always hear it there. They often feature it prominently on their digital page. And, of course, we posted at WCCO Radio's Facebook page. Portions of this are broadcast on my Wednesday afternoon show at 3:30. We will drop another podcast on you next week.